listening to the Massage Therapist Development Initiative. I'm Jamie Johnston.
And I am Eric Purvis. This is a podcast by massage therapists for massage therapists.
Our objective is to simplify how to be a more evidence-informed practitioner. Let's dig into this episode. It's often said that you can't judge a book by its cover. And I think you could say the same when it comes to research. We're going to look at a paper today called Myofascial Release for Chronic Low Back Pain, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. And funny, when I looked at it, I just assumed that they would be trying to point out how wonderful and effective myofascial release is, but the paper tells us otherwise.
Yes, I liked that the title kind of brings you in, right? As a manual therapist, as a massage therapist, you're like, oh, okay, myofascial release, chronic low back pain. All of a sudden, my alarm bells are up, and I was like, oh, I'm going to tear this paper apart. It's going to be crap. Yeah. You know, my bias was coming into effect, and I was like, nope. You know, you'd found this paper and sent it to me. I thought, okay, well, let's just see what it has to say. And I was pleasantly surprised. There's a few things in here which, you know, I didn't agree with, and I'm sure you as well. But I was pleasantly surprised how they went about it, and the findings that they came up with was not what I expected.
No, and it turns out it did confirm my bias as I read through it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, basically, you know, slow, stretchy skin techniques to the low back aren't as wonderful as some people claim.
Yeah.
But there is some positives and there's some nothingness of this. What did I find though is lost or is never mentioned in these studies? And I think this is the problem with these type of studies like this, like these quantitative studies where there's like assigning value or numbers to things, is there's no qualitative aspect of like, what does this mean to the person? Like the person getting we're just going to put it this in air quotes, MFR treatment for the low back, you know, do they value that? Or do they value exercise? Or do they value rest? Do they value medication? Do they value that type of massage technique? Or like, what is it that they want? Because when we're looking at these kind of patient-centered care stuff, you know, all these buzzwords we hear all the time, and that's really the way things should be going is person-centered care. If someone comes in and you give them this like slow, stretchy skin technique of varying forces, whatever feels good for you and the person receiving it, you know, let's say we call that myofascial release. Does the person value that? Is that what they want?
Yeah. Yeah. And rarely
that makes a big difference in terms of the outcomes they're going to come, because you can't force somebody to have something they don't want and expect them to get better.
Yeah. And to go along with that, they also never mention anything about contextual factors of treatment, the interaction between therapist and patient, all those other things that we know matter so much. And granted, in this case, because it's a systematic review, they're just looking at all the papers that have been done. And so it's not necessarily their responsibility at this level of the research to look at that, but at the lower levels of the research of the papers that they would have looked at, it's still not talked about. None of those things are taken into account. And it, you know, it's not talking about the confidence of the therapist in doing those techniques compared to one that they don't like, right? So even though it's, you know, one of the things they looked at was myofascial release versus sham, and I'm not sure what the sham was, but it still showed that, you know, it wasn't any better. So, yes. So it's, you know, I wish that they would start doing research papers that take all of those things we just talked about into account as part of it.
Yeah. And that's the thing that I find is seems to be a problem, is they keep on doing these studies. They keep on putting these papers when they're looking at the same thing again and again and again and again. You think, why don't you just like, and then the conclusion always is more research is needed. Well, why don't you do the other research that is needed rather than doing the same research again? I mean, this paper was done at universities, it looks in China and Italy, looks like is where the researchers were.
It was just done last year.
It was just done, yeah, July 2021. So it's relative, like it's a newish, like a very new study. But yeah, they're putting these resources and times into it, and you're studying myofascial release for chronic low back pain. And I think this is the problem with this. When you call things like this, it tends to probably add more validity to the term myofascial release than it really deserves.
Yeah.
Because if you're doing myofascial release, then someone's gonna be like, that's what I do. I guess what I call my technique. And I think, you know, myofascial release sounds nicer than slow, stretchy skin technique.
Yeah.
You know,
pushy pulley.
Yeah. Triple ST technique. But the problem is that it's inferring that you're making, that you're like imparting change, or you're like creating change in the muscles and fascia.
Yeah.
And that is, and that, and in order for that to be true, that has to be validated first.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that from other studies that your manual techniques don't actually create long-standing changes in that tissue.
Yeah.
Through the mechanisms
proposed.
Proposed, right? So we know it's, there's these neurophysiological things which have these more reflexive effects. But yeah, that's just you know, when you're using the term myofascial, just, it makes a lot of assumptions, right? That, and it I think it creates this idea that tissue needs to be addressed in a specific way for a specific problem in order to get results. And you know, and there's a lot of assumptions made about how this works, right? I think in the paper they talk about like changing visco elasticity of the fascia and increasing blood flow, and you know, increasing neural function through like opening space, creating space for them. I can't
remember the fascia.
And like, okay, well, that's a lot of assumptions. Those are assumptions. Those are not science facts. Those aren't, those are hypotheses. They're not theories.
Which is what a lot of the myofascial release research has been based on.
Yeah, and even in here in this paper, when they talk about near the end, when they're and we'll get to there, I think, but when they talk about the, you know, how this is supposed to work, they're using old research, which isn't even like or they're not even physiological or anatomical studies, really. They're like just old like ideas by like Schlepp and Barnes, you know, and it's just kind of like, okay, well, these are ideas, and they helped us get to where we are now, but those ideas are kind of not fully complete.
We have to put those
some away. Of them are completely wrong.
Yeah, we have to put those away now and go with, you know, start looking at the stuff that Bialoski is doing, and that's the more modern interpretation of what's going on, right? So that's the stuff that should be included in a paper like this when we're talking about how things work. And interesting, like towards the end of this paper, it even talked about like looking through all the papers, they couldn't define one specific technique that was used. It was all different myofascial release techniques that were used. So they can't, it can't even be narrowed down to say, you know, doing a hold on the area around the QL for X amount of time in this direction is the way to do it, because there were so many different styles that were used that they couldn't pinpoint that. And kind of funny to go with that, because I just was looking at a paper recently about manual lymph drainage. And they were trying to say that manual lymph drainage works. And then when you read through the paper, all they do is say, we did general Swedish massage in that area. So they weren't doing MLD technique. They were using Swedish massage and saying manual lymph drainage works.
Wow.
Right. So, so that's like one of the big issues with all of these modality based or technique based things, is that there's nothing concrete about it. And the more that we understand about how things work when we put our hands on people, we can realize that none of these are all outdated ideas and theories that should really be put to bed.
Totally agree. With these things too, what you see is, you know, all these studies, like all these manual therapy studies, right? They all kind of show, doesn't really matter what you do, you name your technique, and they all will show that you'll have a short-term decrease in pain and maybe a little bit of increase in physical function, depending on how those are measured short-term. But it doesn't matter if you use myofascial release or craniosacral or Swedish or, you know, anything else, they all kind of show the same thing, which I know some people might, who are listening, maybe people that they've listened to this podcast before, and like, oh my God, these guys are, you know, who are they? They don't know what they're talking about. We've probably said this a million times over the last how many podcasts we've done now, 25, 30 of them, something like that, that it actually should be empowering to us, because it means we have more opportunities.
100%. And it doesn't,
we don't have to follow these specific protocols. And in the courses that we teach together or individually, you know, we always talk about that. Like, it's just like, explore, be curious, find something that feels good that you like to do that the person likes to do.
Yeah.
Maybe that's, you know, harder, softer, stretchier, faster, slower, it doesn't matter as long as it feels good to the person. That's the person-centered care. You don't have to worry about these very specific interventions. And I know that people are going to argue on that, but I'd say, okay, you can argue that all you want. Yeah. But there's not the data support. You may have your clinical experience to support it, and I would never argue with clinical experience. But the reasons why you're getting those results from your clinical experience are probably very different than what you think.
Yeah.
And this is where we have that ethical obligation as healthcare providers to be less wrong.
Yeah.
Don't claim you're releasing fascia
when we know that that's not possible.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But you can make people feel good doing those techniques.
100%.
Yeah. And that's, I think, where the discussion gets bogged down a little bit.
And funny enough, you know, a discussion that we were involved in offline this morning was something around, I think the term was used, elitism, where, you know, people are, you know, they're discussing things with physios and things like that. And there seems to be this manual therapy elitism. And as I was watching some of the comments around that, I was like, well, you know, people could probably point at us and say the same thing. Because we're pushing so much for evidence-based care, there's probably a certain population of massage therapists that look at us and go, well, these guys are, you know, they're trying to be elitist in what they're doing. But it's just not the case. We're just trying to bring the education up around what we do. So that's sort of a little bit of a tangent off track there, but, you know,
it's our podcast. We can talk whatever we
want. Do whatever we want. But it's, you know, I think we just got to be careful when we're interacting with other therapists and things like that. And like you said, there's probably lots of people that have listened to this and went, these guys are idiots. They don't know what they're talking about. Because we're looking at this stuff and trying to get rid of those old narratives. So, you know, we just probably want to get across that we're not trying to be elitist about anything. We're just trying to bring forward the most up-to-date information about the things we do in order to help other therapists.
And I think that what happens sometimes is that, you know, I know some people before I've seen have said things like, oh, you know, I'm tired of the myth busting, and, you know, I don't believe that when we educate, we should spend so much time busting myths. And I agree with that to some way. But the problem is that having been teaching CECs for so many years now and done them over 100 plus times, when you experiment to try something different and you don't do the myth busting aspect of it, things go sideways because people don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And so, well,
and as long as the myths still exist, we have to do something about that.
Yeah.
Right.
And I would say And I would say we do way less now than we used to. I used to spend so much time on it, but I just kind of got like, well, you know, I'm just kind of tired of doing it because been doing it for 7 or 8 years now, and you think, how many more times do we need to do these bust these myths? Like, these things are, but they're still there in the society, they're still there in the profession. So yeah, we maybe would call it, there's a term, myofascial release, and it's like, oh my god, I've heard these guys say this a million times. But the thing is this is still the common narrative. It's still the common idea within the profession of what's happening. And there's this like higher level of value assigned to certain techniques over others. And you know, I don't think, we're not trying to be elitist. We're just trying to say, look, this is what we do for a living. This is like, we read this stuff. We talk about this stuff. We teach this stuff, you know, and we're trying to change the profession to be more evidence-based, be more up to date, because if we don't make these changes, then we're going to be left behind.
Totally.
And I think that we don't want to be left behind. We want to be seen as leaders. Like, we know we can be leaders in the MSK care. And you know, we've even made that comment before in a course. We said, oh, we need leaders. And we've had people be like, well, I don't think it's fair to put down other people or other professions. Like, that's not what we're saying.
But yeah, we're not.
But why would we not want to strive to be the best at like hands-on and movement-based musculoskeletal care? Why would we not want that? We can do it. It's within our scope.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I'm going to go on a tangent here now, just thinking of like previous like courses we've taught and other podcasts we've been on haven't necessarily been ours. Where, you know, people hear us talk about things like, I think we made some discussions and some stabs at the importance of the psoas muscle on someone else's podcast, the Thinking Practitioner, maybe Whitney Lowe's podcast. We talked about that, and then we got some like from this one listener, got some very kind of like upset emails,
yeah,
basically saying that you know, you should be better than you to calling out this stuff. And, you know, it makes it sound like you're, you know, you think you're above everybody. And we're like, no, like, that's not what we think at all. We're just talking about this stuff because this is still what we hear all the time. Mm-hmm. Now, it was a while ago. I can't exactly remember the context of that. Maybe you might remember, but I just remember thinking, people hear what they want to hear.
Yeah.
And if you say something that makes them feel uncomfortable, they all oftentimes will come at you as trying to be elitist, or being trying to make yourself feel superior, or making trying to make others feel dumb. And like, that's never my intention.
Never the intent. Yeah.
And so sometimes maybe if people feel that way, I'm like, okay, well, maybe I could have said that better. Maybe we could have had that discussion better. Yeah. I don't know, but or maybe sometimes you think, well, maybe that's you. Listen, the listener who's feeling that way, like, because not everybody feels that way.
Yeah. And we're not going to be able to make everybody happy.
No.
Right. There's always going to be somebody who, and everybody has the right to take things the way that they want. And that's fine. But, you know, but I think it really comes down to like when people get their beliefs challenged is typically when we get that kickback. Right. You know, we could go, that's a whole other podcast we could talk about.
We should, yeah.
You know, and I've been doing some learning and some reading around that lately. And it's some really interesting stuff about how the brain always switches to a safety mechanism, even when it comes to that stuff. So when those beliefs get challenged, you know, it's an automatic reaction for the person to get upset and pull back and be like, no. So, you know, could we have done a better job of trying to change the opinion of somebody? I think we're doing our best, and all you can do is do your best. So,
there you go.
People can be offended. That's okay. But we know that there's other people, and there's people in the population that we're helping because those narratives are getting changed.
Yes. Exactly. All right. Do you want to go through
the paper after that rant?
Yeah. We should go put a thing that fast forward 15 minutes in. Do you actually hear the paper?
So one of the things that I looked at with it, and I've just got the paper in front of me, so I'm going to have my head down reading a bit, is when they were selecting the papers they were going to look at, and they looked at the comparison, they looked at myofascial releases versus sham, myofascial release versus exercise, myofascial release and exercise versus exercise, myofascial release and spinal manipulation versus spinal manipulation alone, and myofascial release and physiotherapy program versus just a physiotherapy program. And really interesting, when they looked at the outcomes weren't any better with just myofascial release. So, and that was strictly just looking at pain and doing like the disability pain questionnaires and things like that, that it wasn't any better. But then when it looked at things like, what really stood out to me is like physical function and mental health. And when they looked at things like that, so what really jumped out to me was like kinesiophobia. When they're looking at mental health, that myofascial release did not help at all when it came to things like that. And when we look at it, it's like, well, especially with something like kinesiophobia, how could it possibly help? Because, you know, that's fear around movement, that it's going to cause more pain. So how would somebody laying on the table being passively touched have any effect on that whatsoever? And that's one of the big reasons why we need to incorporate more movement into the treatments that we do in order to help with that aspect of things.
Oh, for sure. And I think with what I get from this, just from the very kind of like general aspect of it, is that, you know, it's like manual therapy or myofascial release, right? It works for pain and it works for certain types of function. Depending on the studies and how they measured it, but everything else kind of works too. So, you know, it's I think this goes back to that initial statement we made, where like it really depends on what the person wants,
yeah,
and what's going to work for them. You know, the one thing that I find is you see a lot in the musculoskeletal literature, which I find to be, I don't know, almost lazy research, is that they do with the A plus B, right? So you look at myofascial release and spinal manipulation versus just spinal manipulation. Mm-hmm. Myofascial release plus physiotherapy program versus physiotherapy program. You're adding two interventions to one. So maybe two interventions are getting more care, more is being done to them. So oftentimes what you see is those studies will produce better outcomes than just one thing alone.
Yeah.
To make this, you know, to make myofascial release as a, that technique to be seen as more valid, it would, you'd have to compare that with another similar technique.
Yes. So say you did myofascial release versus craniosacral.
Sure. Yeah.
Right.
Or myofascial release versus a general Swedish, or yeah, or maybe just myofascial release versus spinal manipulation.
Yeah.
Or myofascial release versus, you know, dry needling. You'd see, like, you know, intervention, you know, comparison, what are the outcomes, and see which one scores better. My assumption would be, based on the data I've seen for other things, is they're kind of the same.
Yeah. And it'd be interesting too, if they did a study that way, if they were to say, take in 100 people who had low back pain, and before they got there, say, what do you prefer, acupuncture or hands-on technique? And they put the people into the things that they thought would work better, and then see what the outcomes are.
Yeah, I think that
Bishop, or put them in the opposite one and see what the outcomes are.
Yeah, Mark Bishop and his research group in Florida, they did something like that with equipoise. Like, they put people into, they had different clinicians who had a different preferred way of treating,
yeah,
spinal manipulative therapy or exercise, and then they just randomly allocated people to the treating clinicians. I could be wrong in this. I'm probably someone. If someone knows the studies, they're like, yeah, you're wrong. But general idea. And what they did is, what they found is that when they asked people afterward, or they, the people treating, the clinicians treating, didn't know what the person's preference for treatment was.
Okay.
Right. And so the clinician got to be able to do a treatment on somebody. And then afterwards, what they did is they looked at the data and said, okay, you know, these 50 people got spinal manipulative therapy. These 50 people had, I don't know, light touch, whatever it is, right? Or an exercise intervention. I can't remember what it was. But what they found was, if I remember correctly, is that when those people that wanted, of those people that were given spinal manipulative therapy, if that's what they liked and that's what they preferred from treatment, and then the provider, that was their preference,
and they're confident things, with it,
and those things matched, the person reported better outcomes. Which goes with kind of with what we're saying here, is that if the person values it and the clinician values it, you're going to probably get better outcomes than if neither party does, or if one party values it and the other one doesn't.
Perfect.
Yeah. Which, and there's a bunch of other studies on that. That's just the one that comes to my mind, 'cause I think that was one of the first ones I read years ago. And maybe we should have a podcast about that, 'cause I'm probably, you know, bastardizing the.
Yeah. We should find that paper and look at it. That'd be cool.
Yeah. No, yeah, I have it somewhere. Yeah. Anyway, one thing too, just when you're talking about the myofascial release, one thing I wanted to just to mention, which I thought, this is a thing that I think is something that's very problematic for people that are reading studies. So if you're reading these studies, have a look. And if you see these type of statements, make sure you read the references that they're coming from. There's one study that they talk about in the introduction. It says, previous studies have found that the psoas muscle fascia may be related to chronic low back pain. That, all of a sudden for me, I thought, really? Okay. And then, so I went and read the other two papers that they took that reference from. And what the authors said, that the conclusions, the conclusions were, we see changes in connective tissues in people with low back pain. This could be either the cause or the effect. So all they're saying is right, that when you have low back pain, it looks like all the tissues that were attaching or around the low back were different than those who didn't have low back pain. And so that's a big leap to say the psoas muscle fascia is contributing to it.
Yeah.
Maybe. And then the authors go on to say in those other studies that, you know, well, people have chronic low back pain, they have different motor control. You know, I think a lot of them had a heavier, they might've been like heavier people.
Like BMI.
BMI might've been bigger or less active, that kind of thing. And so, you know, maybe the changes that we're seeing, because they did it all through ultrasound, are not causative, but maybe they're a response to being in pain for a long time. And that's what other studies have read too. So I think when you see these kind of statements, you're like, so as muscle fascia may be related. Well, those authors did not say that. They said they see a change there. They didn't say it's necessarily causative. And I think that's something that we need to be very mindful of when reading these papers, is these kind of bold statements, go check the references and see what those references have to say.
Yeah. And whenever I read something like that, when it says the psoas muscle may be a contributor, that to me that doesn't tell me that the psoas is a contributor. Whenever it says may, I'm like, okay, that just means that there's a possibility. It doesn't mean it's not a for sure thing. So, you know, just when you're reading it, to me, anytime that it says it may do this, it's not a be all end all. You're referencing a possibility, not an absolute.
Exactly. And if you're familiar with some of the debates about the fascia or the psoas muscles relevance, I think
we have a whole other podcast. It's our most.
We had a whole podcast on that, and TJ did a big, and I think him and Jocelyn might have done a Facebook Live on that maybe a while ago. Anyway,
yeah,
that's been beaten to death. So
yeah, so we don't need to beat it.
I don't need to go talk about that too much. But that was just something I think people, if they're listening, make sure you check the references. The references, if something seems to be a bold claim that doesn't resonate well with you, see where that came from.
Yeah. So it is really. I mean, like I said, this paper confirmed my biases, but it goes through and it talks about physical function, quality of life, balance function, brain pressure threshold, trunk mobility, mental health, all these other things that they picked apart with the information. And it still showed that myofascial release didn't have much of an effect on any of it.
No. And that's something I would love to see, is that they did talk about it in... If you looked at some of the other studies, the researcher that they used for the analysis, they looked at myofascial release and how often people got it,
mm-hmm.
and how long the treatments were. And that was quite varied. They usually, the treatments, I think, were somewhere 40 minutes or so. Yes, it's here 40 minutes once every 2 weeks, or 40 minutes once every 3 weeks over 8 weeks. Some are 40 minutes each once every 2 weeks for 2 weeks. Myofascial release 6 times in total. But they don't actually describe what the author or what the clinician did. Like, what are you calling myofascial release? Like, how are you, is it the same for everybody? Are you doing a same protocol? Is it person-centered? Like, what techniques are you doing? That's the kind of stuff that would be really important for us as massage therapists to know. Now, we don't want to follow a cookie-cutter recipe approach, because that's boring and lame, but it would be nice to know if they're like, yeah, we did this technique and maybe it was just like a slow hold, you know, for 2 minutes.
Yeah, well, that's like what I was mentioning before, just to back up what you're saying, is right at the end of the paper somewhere it makes the statement that they couldn't recreate it because it was all different styles of myofascial release that were being used. It was all different techniques. So
yeah, exactly.
And it's kind of funny because, you know, this probably sounds like we're picking on myofascial release as we discuss this, but you could probably take any manual therapy technique and put it at the title of this and it would still apply the same way.
Right. Yeah. I think that what I seem to see is, because myofascial release is something that, you know, it's for some reason, for whatever reason it is, it's a term, it's a treatment style that's very popular in the world. You know, we have fascia everywhere, and so let's try and manipulate it. And when we do these techniques, they work. And so you have clinical experience of like hundreds of thousands of people and clients that respond well to it. But yeah, there's so many different ways of doing it. And there's so many different ways of touching and moving and manipulating people that, how could you ever say that one is right and one is wrong? I would say that one way is better than the other. And that's, I think, that's one of the problems that we see with this stuff. And but because myofascial release is so popular, and it does, and they do say in here somewhere that, you know, it usually involves holding for like 100 to 300 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then people feel better. But then if we look at what some of the neurophysiological things that occur with these slow, sustained stretch techniques, and when you put that force into tissue, we do see that there is an anti-nociceptive effect through activation of a variety of things, but one of them being, I believe it's Ruffini corpuscles.
Yeah, because they're the pressure receptors, right?
Yeah, I think it's right. So, and some, I can't remember. I should know. When I teach this stuff, I should know off the top of my head, but I'm tired. I just got back from vacation, so my brain's a little bit fried. When you do the slow, stretchy skin techniques, there's certain receptors in the skin and upper layer of the connective tissues that do actually slow down noxious stimuli to the spinal cord. So that's why people feel better after a massage, right? It doesn't have to be necessarily that slow, sustained one, but from what I've read before and other neurophysiological studies, is that when those things are held for a certain period of time, they become more activated, and that's going to create a larger anti-nociceptive effect. So maybe myofascial release isn't changing the fascia. Maybe it is more likely being that you're activating these receptors, which is changing the sensory input that your body's, that your spinal cord and your brain is receiving. That to me makes more sense, because we can measure that.
And that's how every technique works.
And that's how every technique works. Right? Yeah. So anyway, that's just something I really wish that we would embrace as a profession rather than chasing all these techniques.
Well, I was having a thought the other day, and this can go back to, and I was writing a blog post about it. The whole thing where we get our beliefs challenged. And I was thinking, well, what if when we were in college, we didn't actually name any of the technique courses? It was just called Manual Therapy Technique Class 1.
Yes.
And then we had equal amounts of classes in research and exercise as we did to manual technique courses. So what if we had 5 classes on how to do a massage, 5 classes on some exercise, and 5 classes on some research, and all we called all the classes were massage therapy technique or manual therapy technique?
Yeah.
Then when we got out of school, we wouldn't run into this whole identity thing where it's, well, I'm a myofascial release therapist, or I'm a craniosacral therapist, or I'm a general Swedish massage therapist, or I'm this and that. It would be just, I'm a manual therapist.
Yeah.
And then it wouldn't be so daunting when those beliefs get challenged, because the beliefs wouldn't be there for the most part.
Right. Well, because they're put in there by school, right? And we learned that before. And you know, I think I've talked about it before, is that what you learn in school forms a foundation for how you're going to practice. And it's very hard to unlearn those things.
Yeah.
And I agree. I love that idea that if we could just stop naming these techniques as like the special thing, but teach a variety of those techniques, but teach them under like a general manual skills thing.
Yeah.
And use those techniques to work with specific populations. So teach people some manual skills. Well, here's some different ways. This is like what we would normally call Swedish massage, these kind of longer, slower, or faster kind of sliding and gliding techniques. And here's ones that are these stretchier ones, and ones that maybe a little more specific. Maybe you want to use like your thumbs, your fingers, your knuckles, your elbow, whatever. Yeah. You know, here's ones that are maybe a little more pressure. You know, here's ones more like maybe you're doing some trigger point type things with a little more pressure in a certain spot or whatever that looks like. You know, like give people, teach everyone the skills on how to touch, because that's really important. And that's what I think separates us from other MSK professions, is we do as a profession have our touch is better in terms of that, because that's what we do all day.
We have more experience with touch.
We're more experienced. Yeah, I shouldn't say better, but you know, we're more experienced with it. So, but yeah, just, and so that way you move away from all these different name techniques, and it creates people to kind of pick and choose what they want to do rather than just gravitating towards a specific way of thinking.
Yeah.
And you could easily do it. You could be, here's all these populations that you're going to treat. Here's a class on geriatrics. Here's a class on pediatrics. Here's a class on sport. Here's a class on, you know, surgical rehab. Here's one on like, I know we did some neurological stuff, but all that stuff was very,
it was quick.
Quick. And there wasn't really a lot of thought process. It's like, well, I can use these techniques for this person.
Yeah.
But you don't really talk to think about it. I mean, I know some schools probably do a better job than others, but when we went to school, you weren't really taught to think. You were taught just basically copy and paste.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was it? The neural stuff was like Rude's techniques and things like that.
Yeah. You had a couple other technique things that you learned, but yeah, the focus was always on technique. And it was never enough on like critical thinking or interaction or how would I communicate with this person? How would I explain to them what's going on? Because they're going to be like, why do I hurt? What's going on? Yeah. What are some strategies that you can use that aren't like pathoanatomical tissue blaming?
Yeah.
Unless there is a tissue Yeah, you're injured.
Yeah.
It is inflamed here. That's going to take, 4 or 6 weeks to recover, or like just to learn these basic things, which we do in clinic. But I find that when people come out of school, they're not given that. They're just given a very too basic.
Yeah.
And I think that can result in more, well, not the type of quality care
that it results in what we have now.
What's that?
It results in what we have now.
Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah, that would be nice to change those techniques. And I like that you brought that up. That's good.
Yeah, I've been looking at a lot of stuff about that whole belief system thing lately, and I'm trying to make change. So
we'll
see how that goes. But
yeah,
some thought reversal kind of stuff about that. But,
for sure. Yeah. No, it's important stuff, right?
Yeah. Well, I think we beat a lot of that to death. But I think getting towards the end of the paper, it also pointed out there was like 5 or 6 points that it made about basically why the research they looked at wasn't good, which is important to take into account. And some of the things that they pointed out is like a lot of the papers didn't have long-term follow-up with the patients to show whether the pain relief or whatever lasted for them. It talked about, like, it didn't include things about disease duration, how long this had been going on for them. There was risks in terms of randomization. So there was like a whole list of things that they pointed out why there needs to be more research done on this stuff, because the research we have isn't good.
Yeah, they said that the quality of evidence too was only at the best, it was moderate, and that was for pain and physical function, which is what they said the conclusions were from the data, that pain and physical function is the best thing for that we can say myofascial release does based on the current data we have. All the other stuff was low or very low, but it was only moderate, so it's not like high quality level of evidence. So it's like it's okay, but it's not great. But that seems pretty consistent with what you see in most other any type of manual or massage therapy literature, is that the outcomes tend to be moderate, at best, for short term. And we all know clinically, right? People come to see us, they leave, they often will feel better.
Yeah.
And but
there's so many things that go into that, more than just us putting our hands on them.
Exactly. More than just the technique, right? So, yeah. What I did like, though, in this paper, though, was they did say, when they're talking about the limitations and talking near the end, right? They're talking about, like, they say, integration of sensory information, central nervous system processing, neuromuscular activity, and they start using a lot of like proprioceptors, the overall adjustment of the nervous system. They talk about all this. They start talking about all these other things that occur. So it's funny. It's just funny to me that they start off the paper being like, myofascial release is supposed to do these things, but then when they go to talk about the outcomes and the things that you see in people with, when they're looking at their measurements, like, these are all the things that we see in proprioception, sensory challenges, and this kind of thing. And you're like, now they're talking about neurophysiological stuff, which I feel like they should have been talking about that earlier, when they kind of were building the background to this.
Yeah. Well, it's funny when they're building that background part, the part you've commented on a couple times, it was like a long couple paragraphs where they were basically saying, this is what the papers say myofascial release does.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went through, and I kind of glossed over a bunch of that, because I'm like, no, it doesn't do that. But they were referencing what the papers say, and then get into what manual therapy actually does with the stuff you're just talking about, the neurophysiological input and things like that. So it's good that they came around to almost correct that part of it.
Yeah, which made me feel happier with it too. And they did say, it kind of has short-term impacts, but it's not great.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be better than much else that's out there.
Yes.
But they did say, at the end too, which was great. They said future randomized controlled trials should strictly limit interventions and reduce the use of combination interventions, which is what we were saying earlier, like the A plus B, right? You do this and this versus this. No, just do like a single one to see, is this type of treatment, and can you quantify that treatment, or can you put it into like something like, this is something that we're going to deliver. Like, this is how we're going to do it. Mm-hmm. Which I know isn't very person-centered, but if you're wanting to see if a technique works, it has to be standardized.
Yeah.
Like, you have to, like, this is what we're going to do for all these people that come in that score whatever it is on this back pain measure. And then we're going to do this very specific protocol and we're going to see what happens. Right. And you probably, the results probably aren't going to be great, but at least you know, they're not going to, it's not going to be like, whoa, amazing. We've, you know, found the cure.
Yeah.
But I think that's would be a better way of doing these studies. So we could say, look, this type of technique can help, or this type of technique, meh, doesn't, it's, that's what we like to do. Go ahead and do it, which I think is what I got from this. Was that,
yeah. You know,
if you like to do it, go ahead and do it. It's not going to be the be all end all. If it works for you, if it works for people who come to see you, then it is part of the overall treatment plan.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that I take from papers like this as well is it really reinforces to me why the clinical guidelines of MSK care are education, reassurance, movement, and some manual therapy. Right? Because we know that reassurance and education plays a huge role in the mental health and the functional aspect of things. And then, of course, so does integrating the movement into things because of things like kinesiophobia and you know, other issues that people have. So it really reinforces to me why manual therapy is the thing at the bottom of the list and why those other things are more important, because it shows that the technique alone doesn't really do a whole lot by comparison with pain and physical function and all these other things.
It's a piece of the overall puzzle.
Totally.
Yeah.
So I think to kind of wrap it up and to go back to what you were just commenting on is, if you really like doing myofascial release techniques and your patients like it, continue to do them. But the problem is that we just need to change the narrative around it. We need to stop telling people that we're releasing fascia. We have to, you know, change those things and start talking about, you know, inputs to the nervous system and how things actually work. And then, of course, start, if you're not already, start integrating more movement, education, and reassurance as part of your treatment plan with your people.
Make people feel good. Touch them in a way that feels nice. As we always say, TPN, touch people nicely.
Yeah.
That's a subjective thing, right? That's totally different for everybody. So it doesn't mean you have to be super gentle. It doesn't mean you have to be, you know, it doesn't mean you don't touch them. It just means find touch that feels good.
Yeah.
Make them feel good. Give them movement if they value movement, or find them to do something that's important to them as well. Because yeah, that's the A plus B, right? If they can do something else as well, or when they're not in the treatment with you, that's going to be, in most of the population, that's going to be good for them.
Yeah. And make that interaction with them meaningful to them, right? Make the treatment, make the movement, make the home care all meaningful to that person. And you're probably going to have better outcomes than just doing myofascial release alone.
And I think what you said beautifully in our last podcast was you talked about engage in treatment rather than just give or provide treatment, engage in treatment. So I think I like that. I think that plays really well with kind of wrapping up this discussion is, yeah, engage with people, right? Have them have a say in what they want to do and what they like to do and facilitate that for them.
Yes. Perfect. We'll end it there. All right. See you next time, everybody. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. These kind of topics are what we are all about. If you'd like to learn more, go to our websites,
themtdc.com or ericpurvis.com. If you know of any other therapists that could benefit from this, please tell them to subscribe.